This episode of It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine was made possible by contributions from slaves like you. Spanky very much.
A bomb ripped through an electric power project in British Columbia early this morning, and it looks like sabotage.
Four huge voltage regulators at the Cheekai-Dunsmuir hydro plant on Vancouver Island were destroyed after dynamite charges exploded. The bombers apparently cut their way through a chain-link fence and set off the blast when no workers were at the site. A group calling itself Direct Action has claimed responsibility.
It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine.
Good morning, slaves, and welcome to another edition of It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine, where reality sandwiches are served with a pickle. I'm your host, The Stimulator, and in oil news, the chief economist of the International Energy Agency has stated that world oil supplies are running out fast. Dr. Fatih Birol told the Independent of London that
one day we will run out of oil. It is not today or tomorrow, but one day we will run out of oil, and we have to leave oil before oil leaves us.
When asked how much oil is left, Dr. Birol said, about this much. So since there's so little oil left, the United States is turning to much dirtier fuels just north of the border.
The State Department has been delegated authority from the President to receive applications for the construction, connection, operation, and maintenance of facilities at the border of the United States, including petroleum pipelines. And after considerable review and evaluation today, the Department issued a presidential permit to Enbridge Energy Limited Partnership for the Alberta Clipper Pipeline.
That was Assistant Secretary of State Philip J. Crowley. What this government minion didn't tell you is that the Clipper Pipeline will be sending down a putrid excuse for oil from
the mother of tar sands.
But more on that after the break. And speaking of toxic tubes, the alleged bomber of gas pipelines in Dawson's Creek, Canada, has warned Encana, the owner of the pipelines, to get the fuck out of Dodge or else. An anonymous letter sent to a local rag read,
"Cease all your activities and remove all your installations. Return the land to what it was before you came. Every last bit of it, before things get a lot worse for you and your terrorist pals in the oil and gas industry."
The letter prompted Encana to double the reward money for snitching from $500,000 to $1 million Canadian dollars. So far, no information has come forth because of the reward.
The World Wildlife Fund has published its annual scorecard ranking the performance of each country, and the news isn't good for Canada. It has fallen to last place among G8 nations.
Oh, snack. How embarrassing.
What's happened this year is with the new Obama administration in the United States, they've done more in the last 6 months than the United States has done in the last 30 years on climate.
Wait a motherfucker a minute. Go back to Hillary Clinton's Yes Man. Thanks.
But at the same time, we will continue to work internationally and with Canada to address the climate change problem.
Looks like the climate strategy of the Obama administration is to export its pollution next door, which is good news for Canada's evil motherfucker Prime Minister Stephen Harper. You see, there's a shitload of ice in the north of Canada that has been melting rapidly due to
man-made climate change.
Once this ice is gone, new oil and mineral finds might be revealed, along with a profitable trade route known as the Northwest Passage. This is the reason why Harper has been waving his military in northern Canada this summer. But the mother of the resistance is working hard to stop the ice from melting. In West Virginia, two fearless earth defenders set up a tree sit, which caused the evil coal gluttons at Massey Energy from blasting around a mountaintop removal site. In the UK, troublemakers are getting ready for the annual climate camp action. More on that on the next show. And in sad motherfucking news, freedom fighter Leonard Peltier was denied parole. Peltier is a member of AIM, or American Indian Movement, and has been in prison for more than 36 years for allegedly killing two FBI agents during a gun battle at the Pine Ridge Reservation. Peltier will not be eligible for parole until 2024. Our hearts are with you, hermano.
Your loose it on the wall, playing tic-tac-toe. Yo, check being on the level of our unconsciousness. For example, what does the billboard say? Come and play, come and play. Forget about the movement.
Anger is a gift.
This summer, La Malvada and I pedaled over 700 miles through British Columbia and the Yukon Territories on secondary roads. My expectations were to see remote, pristine wilderness throughout our bicycle trip. But the reality was a bit more disappointing. In BC, there were clear cuts almost everywhere we went. There was also evidence that mining interests are poking around these parts, so once all the trees are gone, greedy motherfuckers can extract the last bit of profit from the earth's guts. Further north in the Yukon, where trees of the boreal forest are much smaller than those in BC, we saw almost no evidence of logging. The picture of unharmed wilderness was almost fulfilled. Yes, we still have huge chunks of wilderness that hasn't been fucked with, but it's not much. This bicycle trip up north has strengthened my resolve to be a part of a movement that stuffed the insanity that is civilization. One of the most insane and destructive projects civilization is undertaking threatens to wipe out a big chunk of Canada's boreal forest, pollute rivers and streams, and almost certainly wreck the climate to the point of no return.
The Mammoth of Tarzan
has been called the most destructive project on Earth, and is one that must be stopped by any means necessary. To find out more about the Mother of Tarzans, I spoke with McDonald Stainsby of oilsandstruth.org. Hey McDonald, how the fuck are you?
Well, the first thing to say about the Tarzans is we talk about how...
Wait, hold your horses. I haven't even asked a question. So, what the fuck are
the Mother of Tarzans?
Basically, the largest oil deposit in the world outside of Saudi Arabia. But that's a bit of a misnomer because Tarzans really aren't oil. Effectively, the process by which you mine and refine tar sands is effectively adding about 100 million years of development through a synthetic process. The tar sand deposit in an area that covers the size of the state of New York or larger than England is already considered the largest industrial project in human history, and it's barely begun. To do with the mining, which is the bulk of the tar sands production these days, one has to first clear the ground of all forests in all directions. And then they do what they call breaking the ground, which is to strip all the water off and suck it off in what areas are considered right now some of the largest and most important muskeg or wetlands that exist in North America. It's in the heart of the boreal forest. As I said, the size of the area, there should also be discussion of the size of the mines in the Athabasca region, north of the famous city of Fort McMurray, the modern-day gold rush town. In the area there, to produce one barrel of oil, you have to first, after you've cleared off the ground and broken all the trees down and so forth, then dig a pit which can be up to 200 feet deep. For each barrel of oil, there's 4 barrels of water used in a process called a slurry, where you spin it at a high speed, high velocity, with high temperatures of water to separate the bitumen, which is the pre-synthetic oil, from the tar sands, from the sands itself and all of the clays and silts. But that's after you've already dug out what has to be hundreds of tons of earth. Approximately 2 to 4 tons of earth are used, again, just to make one barrel of oil. They're also going to be using about 1/3 of the energy input to get the energy out. So the ratio that's most important to talk about is a ratio you could use in a country like Iraq, where for each barrel of oil you use to try to get more oil, you'll get about 100 barrels back. In the tar sands, it can be between 3 to 5. They've got some plans right now which would actually reduce that even further. So that's the kind of ratio we're dealing with here. So those energy needs have to come from somewhere. They come from natural gas and coal-fired plants, ostensibly. There's other developments that are also working on that.
And who will be consuming this dirty oil?
Well, the United States, because of the Security and Prosperity Partnership, and previous to that, NAFTA, and previous to that, free trade agreement signed between just Canada and the United States, has something called the Proportionality Clause, which states that if 70% of a given resource goes to the United States on any particular day from Canada, it can never be reduced below that level. We're currently sitting at, I believe, at 63% or something like that of tar sands bitumen and tar sands synthetic oil being sent already to the United States. As production increases from the 1.3 to 1.4 million barrels a day today to let's say if they actually achieve 4 to 5 or 6 million barrels a day, then you'll be looking at 4.5 million barrels a day approximately. Out of that six, will be going straight to the United States. 20% of the United States reserve goes to the United States military, so you could say the tar sands are currently the number one supplier to U.S. imperialism around the world.
The group Environmental Defense has called the tar sands the most destructive project on Earth. Just what the fuck do they mean?
Well, the Environmental Defense, I would say, only understates the case. The way to look at it is that the tar sands are not only fueling the destruction of the second fastest rate of deforestation in the world outside of the Amazon River Basin, or Amazon Rainforest Basin, they're also currently about to become, well, they're already the second fastest contributor to climate change in North America, and with the goals of production that they're talking about, the CO2 emissions will make it so the only way you could outstrip a climate change contributor for all of North America would be to combine all of the coal-fired power plants from Alberta to Arizona and in between across all of North America. You also have to look at what's happening with water. We hear about how much fresh water exists in Canada, but as Dr. David Schindler, biological sciences professor from the University of Alberta, has explained to people, it's really important to note that the only water that's actually a renewable resource is that which gets replenished each year when there's the runoff from the melting of glaciers and the previous year's snowpack. So when you factor all that in, only 1% of all the fresh water that exists in Canada is actually renewable. 25% of all of the fresh water from not just Canada, but all of North America comes from the Mackenzie River Basin, which includes the Athabasca River. When you destroy the Athabasca and therefore irrevocably poison the Mackenzie River, as well as the Slave, as well as the Great Slave Lake, and other tributaries along the way, you're actually destroying 25% of the freshwater. And when we're going into the century that people are already saying the last century's wars were fought about oil, this next century's wars will be fought about water, and we're actually fighting a war against water itself, not just over it already.
He's a marketing dream. But like Calvin Klein or Benetton, he's a brand that promises something special, something exciting, almost risque, as if he might be radical. As if he might enact change. He makes people feel good. He's a postmodern man with no political baggage. And all that's fake.
It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine.
Good morning, slaves, and welcome to another edition of It's the End of the World as We Know It and I Feel Fine, where elevating the discourse is our lowest priority. I am your host, The Stimulator, and the smackdown you just heard comes courtesy of John Pilger. And no, he was not making a eulogy for Jacko. Mr. Pilger is an Australian filmmaker who puts that fat mouth Michael Moore to shame. More recently, Mr. Pilger produced The War on Democracy, an in-depth look at the continued war that the imperialista gringos y juegan parío have been waging on my Latino brothers and sisters for more than a century. Let's hear a little more from that master of disaster.
During his brief period in the Senate, Obama voted to continue the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He voted for the Patriot Act. He refused to support a bill for single-payer health care. He supported the death penalty. He received more corporate backing than John McCain. He promised to close Guantanamo as a priority. But instead, he's excused torture, reinstated military commissions, kept the Bush gulag intact, and opposed habeas corpus.
Oh, snack. This is just too easy. Now, for most of you who watch the show religiously, none of this is new. But people are always asking me to provide them with tools to wake up their family and friends from their opium-induced buzz. Pilger's entire speech will be linked from my website, stimulator.tv. Here's another little nugget.
In Colombia, he is planning to spend $46 million on a new military base that will support a regime backed by death squads and further the tragic history of Washington's intervention in that region.
It appears that that nose that your mama calls Obama is going to continue in the time-honored presidential tradition of the issue in Latin America. Obama and his crew are ramping up U.S. military presence in Colombia to supposedly fight drug cartels, but if our coke-sniffing president was really serious about fighting narco-traffic, he would simply dissolve the CIA.
Men who were working for the CIA's army were responsible for bringing all that cocaine into Los Angeles that sparked the crack epidemic.
President Obama, I want to express our gratitude again to you, to your cabinet, and to the United States.
That groveling suck-up is Colombian President Álvaro Uribe, who after residing in Obama's butthole, emerged with a promise of American military pilots, aircraft, and intelligence support. This deal will give the U.S. access to 7 military bases and a strategic presence for when they decide to take out Hugo, Evo, Rafael, and Fernando. You see, while George W. Bush was busy killing brown babies over in Iraq, my peeps down south were cleaning house and getting rid of the ruling classes that for years sucked Washington's c**k and permitted the wholesale slaughter of any opposition to American imperialism. One of these cleaners is Ecuador's President Rafael Correa, who did not renew the lease of an Air Force base in the city of Manta. When asked why he did not want the Americans to rocket from Ecuador from now on, El Señor Correa responded,
Porque sí. Why renew it? Okay. Mire, si quiere, yo lo renuevo con una condición.
Now, if you'd like, I would renew it with one condition.
Que me permitan poner una base militar ecuatoriana aquí en Nueva York.
That they allow me to set up an Ecuadorian military base here in New York.
Meanwhile, in Honduras, people have been hitting the streets nonstop to oppose the coup that forced democratically elected President Manuel Zelaya to flee the country. The motherfucking resistance has been met with hardcore police violence, including allegations of gang rapes, but the Obama administration remains mum on the issue. Also silent are the thousands of fuckheads who tweeted till their fingers bled during the disputed Iranian election. Or could it be that the puppet masters have already found a way to fuck with Twitter?
The use of Twitter is a very important one, not only to the Iranian people, but now increasingly to people around the world.
On the other side of the world, the annual climate camp descended on London, ground zero for global capitalism. Activists blocked the entrance of the carbon exchange to protest the commodification of the global warming gas in an action they called Climate Casino. The troublemakers are accusing the carbon traders with gambling with the planet's future.
For weeks, the city's been preparing for the G20 summit, a gathering of world leaders discussing the economic crisis. And like previous summits, anarchists are expected to show up in large numbers.
Yep, it's that time again to make trouble for the 20 gangsters of the industrialized world. This time, our so-called rulers will be descending upon Pittsburgh, but the motherfucking resistance will be there. Patrick Young of the Pittsburgh Organizing Group explains some of the reasons why we must oppose these evil capitalists.
They've created this bubble that has led to the worst financial crisis in our lifetimes, my lifetime and your lifetime. We're seeing unemployment go through the roof. We're seeing people across the country and around the world lose their homes.
But residents of the Steel City have other more sinister things to fear.
Protesters carrying gas masks and PCP pipe.
Your mind. Politic needs human beings. Politic need lies. That's why, my friend, it's an evidence. Politic is violence. Why, my friend, it's an evidence. Politic is violence.
It has been a year since the combined cluster of the Republican conventions in Denver and St. Paul's. The resistance accomplished much during these rebellions, and many were inspired by how far a little bit of good planning can go to cause big headaches to those in power. In Vancouver, where I live, corporatists have hijacked the city and are holding a big fiasco that they call the Winter Olympics. I call them
the Five Rings of Death.
A call-out has been issued for troublemakers of all stripes to come and oppose this festival of nationalism and corporate rule. But the tricky part is convincing y'all to oppose an event that's supposed to promote goodwill and sportsmanship. It's like asking someone to oppose Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny. To dispel these myths of Olympic proportions, I bring you Gord Hill of No2010.com and a member of the Olympic Resistance Movement. Hey Gord, how the f*** are you?
I'm doing good, thank you.
So, what the f*** the Olympics?
The Olympics are a huge multi-billion dollar industry that's, you know, the governments and corporations working hand in hand to make more money and at the expense of the poor and the environment.
Is it true that there is a long history of fascism within the Olympics?
Yeah, if you look at the history of the modern Olympics, Avery Brundage, he was one of the most well-known Nazi sympathizers in the U.S. Olympic Committee, and he ended up becoming an IOC president. Samaranch, who was one of the last long-term IOC presidents, he was a part of Franco's fascist regime in Spain. And then you had the Nazi Olympics where, you know, it basically bolstered the Nazi regime, and that's where they got the idea for the torch relay to promote Nazi fascism throughout Western Europe. And then you had the Mexico City Olympics where there was a massacre just days before the Olympic Games on the part of the Mexican government to ensure that there was a peace and order during the Olympic Games. You know, there was like over 300 people, mostly students, shot and killed by the Mexican military and police. And then you look at some of the other games as well, where they've allied themselves with the most authoritarian military regimes in Asia, the most recent one being Beijing, and then before that there was the South Korea, which was in the midst of a military dictatorship when they were awarded the games.
So are the Olympics a Trojan horse to insert fascism into Vancouver?
Yeah, I think if you look at the you know, the pattern of Olympic Games, these types of big mass spectacles, it's like a catalyst for social change in those areas where they set up. With the Olympics, you see the pattern of large scale restructuring of urban areas, which results in the relocation, the dislocation, the dispersal of poor, low income people and housing, especially. Then you have the establishment of a large security state to secure the games, which is usually large budgets for police and military. Some of the most recent games, like Athens and Beijing, you know, a huge security apparatus that was set up. 300,000 CCTV video cameras in Beijing, a whole network of informants, the same in Athens, the same in all the other cities that have held these games as well. The BC government and their corporate backers are looking at the Olympics as a means of opening up the province and the region to greater international investment, especially in certain industries like mining, oil and gas, and tourism. So that's why the ruling class of a city want the games to come in, because it acts as this kind of catalyst for economic development. And the police and that, they want it because it inflates their budgets and that. So you have this like little network of people, including people involved in land development, condos, these types of industry, that they're the ones who are on the bid committees, for example, who organize and compete with other cities to get the Olympic Games into their respective cities. So if you just look at who comprises the bid committees and the local organizing committees, you'll always find the same types of characters.
What the f*** is the Olympic Resistance Network?
The Olympic Resistance Network, or the ORN, is comprised of a number of different community, grassroots, political organizations that have organized themselves to oppose the Olympic Games.
The slogan for the ORN is, "No Olympics on Stolen Native Land." Just what the f*** does that mean?
Well, here in BC in particular, it refers to the history of colonialism here in the province and the lack of treaties that the government was required by its own laws to make in its western expansion across Canada. So if you go back to the British had put in place a 1763 Royal Proclamation after they had defeated France and they had to reorganize their North American colony. So the 1763 Royal Proclamation legally bound the British to make treaties as they expanded westward. And this is what they did. If you look at the history of Canada, you have these treaties, Treaty No. 1, Treaty No. 2, they're called the numbered treaties that encompass parts of Ontario and the provinces, you know, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta. Vast tracts of land that were ceded in these treaties in exchange for food and stuff like this. So when they got to BC, which was just forming itself as a colony at that time under the British, they started to make treaties. The first ones are known as the Douglas Treaties, after the first governor, and he made a number of small treaties on Vancouver Island. And then after that, they just stopped the process and just imposed government control over all these indigenous lands here in the province. So when we say there's no Olympics on stolen native land, it's to raise people's awareness and consciousness about this history, about the lack of treaties, and which really challenges the legal basis for the governance here in the province. Because what we're saying is, like, it's illegal and it's actually immoral, because they were bound by their own laws to make treaties before they settled on any land or any business took place on sovereign indigenous lands.
What future actions are planned to disrupt this bull?
So the Olympic torch relay is going to begin October 30th, and it's going to start from Victoria. Then it's going to travel up Vancouver Island, and then it's going to go up into northern Canada and cross over to the east coast, and then start again on land and cross over back to Vancouver for February 12th, 2010. It's one of the largest land torch relays, one of the longest in the Olympic history. And so we are organizing to disrupt the torch relay, beginning with its send-off in Victoria, and we're calling on people in other communities where the relay passes through to also challenge it, oppose it, disrupt it if possible. Most recently, representatives from the four host First Nations, which are the Native Collaborator Sellouts, we're in Six Nations, Ontario, trying to gather support for the torch relay passing through that community. And they were challenged there also by, you know, indigenous comrades there. So we're hoping that, as in 2008, when the international torch relay was being conducted for China, the Beijing Games, you know, it was massively disrupted because of China's invasion of Tibet at that time, the violence that was occurring there. But we're hoping to disrupt the torch relay based on the same kind of principles, you know, anti-colonial, anti-capitalist resistance.
Thanks, Gord. And that about does it for this edition of It's the End of the World as We Know It, and I Feel Fine. The following slaves chipped in to help fund this edition: Christine, Cillian, Michael, Kim, Weston, and Stuart. Kopupa. To comment on this show or for links on the Olympic resistance, just visit my website, stimulator.tv. Now go get yourself a super soaker.
Remember, kids, you can podcast high-quality video of this show at submedia.tv.